Out here, if you're doing nothing, you're doing everything right. Though on a cruise with Norwegian, even if you're doing nothing, you're still basking in the warm sun, enjoying the peaceful ocean waves, you're breathing. Don't forget about breathing. Definitely need to be breathing. So you get to do nothing, or everything, but you still need to be breathing. It's like really important.
Experience the difference with cruises to Alaska, the Caribbean, and Europe. Norwegian Cruise Line. It's different out here. Visit ncl.com, call your travel advisor, or 1-888-NCL-CRUISE. Norwegian Cruise Line ships registry, the Bahamas and USA.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. Today we're doing part one of Oldsmobile, a two-part series on the somewhat forgotten, I'll say, American car brand. But we'll find out they were extremely successful in their early years. They went through a lot, made some huge innovations. They were the first car company to ever export an American car. They were the first company to build like a facility for building cars. They fell flat on their face and then it rebounded to become one of the biggest companies in the US. Really interesting story, and we're gonna get right into it right now. In the vast history of human civilization, only a select few men have been influential enough to have a mobile named after them. Batman, the Pope, and of course, Ransom Olds. Olds invented his namesake Oldsmobile, and in doing so became one of the forefathers of the American auto industry. His company would go on to build some of the country's most influential cars, introduce groundbreaking technologies, and help establish General Motors as an industrial giant. But then, after 107 years of innovation, Oldsmobile simply vanished. How did Oldsmobile play a part in GM's dominance of the auto industry? Was Ransom Olds actually more influential than Henry Ford? And why did America's oldest surviving car company get the axe after more than 100 years of production? This week on Pass Gas, it's Oldsmobile, Part 1. Welcome back to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Welcome to Pass Gas. Across from me is Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me. Love today's topic.
And Joe Weber.
What's up, Wink Wink Nation?
That's it?
Yeah, he was waiting for an answer from the nation.
Yeah, it's Bart, in my ear.
You have an Oldsmobile.
I was pressured into getting rid of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still regret it.
What's taking its place in the garage?
I have to bring out Impala from Philly.
That's pretty
next
cool.
On the docket.
What year?
The Impala is a 65.
Oh, man.
Okay. Let's get the Oldsmobile, though.
Mm-hmm. That was an 83.
83 Olds. What was the model?
It was a 83 Oldsmobile Regency 98. They love numbers.
Yeah, 98.
So it was the full size.
Pretty old model.
Had the 5.7 liter, the 350, which was affectionately named the boat anchor. made 180 horsepower.
This thing's big.
It's big. It was big.
Oh, man.
I had it for 20 years.
Wow.
This thing's pretty cool.
Yeah. I think about it. There, not a week goes by where I don't think about that car.
It was like a gold, copper kind of color?
It was, yeah, it was.
It was like a root beer. Mm-hmm. Like if you hold up a root beer,
I think I
candy,
saw it once when I went to your house.
Are you talking like Buffalo Bill?
Through, if you look through the root beer candy and the sparkles,
is this like a line
like
from Silence of the Lambs?
It's something James and I used to do as a joke back and forth.
Dude, one of these with a freaking blower sticking out the hood, dude.
Yeah, I saw it, and then I went to a Radwood and I ran into a couple people. What happened was it was the transmission. Mm-hmm. And really all it was, I found out later that there's a sleeve around the transmission that it's what catches it. Mm-hmm. on the Oldsmobile, and a lot of the drag cars that use an automatic. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. But once, if you change the fluid or something maintenance, mm-hmm. you got to crank it down. There's like a screw that will adjust it. And what was funny is I would go to like a transmission shop and be like, this is exactly what happened. Doesn't make sense. It's just not shifting out of first. And they're like, oh, you need a new transmission.
Of course.
Oh, yeah. You need a,
I was like, I'm not. And then, yeah. Anyway, so it sat in the driveway for a while. And then Nikki was like, we got it, Bart.
Yeah.
Get rid of this.
Was this one of your parents' cars?
Or? It was my grandfather's and then my grandmother's. Okay. And so I live after college. My grandmother got sick, and she lived in Cincinnati. And I was kind of like, well, I'm the only one in our family, mm-hmm. either my uncle or my dad. I'm like, I'm not doing anything yet. So I lived with my grandmother in Cincinnati for about 3 to 6 months or something. And then she went to assisted living, and she was like, Bart, do you want the car? So me and my buddy drove up from Louisville, and
yeah,
dang, that's sick.
That was it.
Got some Skyline chili, got a Oldsmobile yeah. 98.
It is huge. Mm-hmm. It's a lot bigger than I remember seeing it in your garage there or at your house. Yeah.
Yeah, and it glided. James used to, like, James borrowed it for like a year. Like, got one. I was like, all right.
I can't imagine driving this around, trying to find parking in LA. This thing's like 20 feet long.
I got so good at driving and parking because of that car. Yeah. And people are like, there's no way. And it's
watch
just.
Watch this.
Yeah.
It's like the styling is your classic, like,
the other thing
Malaise era kind of styling. But it's a huge SUV or a sedan.
Looking at it, if you look at it and revisit those full size, there are things that we were getting from Germany in the design. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I can see what they were going for.
From the early 80s?
It's a pretty good looking car, I think. Yeah. Like from the front.
You look at it at the angles, makes sense. The other fun thing was whenever I'd go to like a park or like Griffith Park, or it's always like authorized vehicles only, mm-hmm. and it was an outline of my car. So I was like, well,
I'm authorized.
Yeah, it fits.
That looks like me.
It's like one of those game shows where you have to fit through the like shape of your...
Dang, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty sick.
Here. Anyway, I learned how to...
It's a coupe?
Work on cars.
That's a sedan. Sedan.
Yeah.
There are coupes, it looks like, though.
I learned to work on cars because that was my only car.
Yeah.
And so anything, something happened, I did the brake lines.
There's a coupe, wow.
I did, you know, like, it's like all this stuff where it's like, well, I'm not going to pay somebody to fix a $3,000 car.
Yeah.
You know? But anyways.
Well, it's
fond memories.
That is the V8 that they had for like 40 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it came from the Rocket V8 in the early 40s, so.
Well, we'll find out more.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Ransom Eli Olds was born in 1864 in Geneva, Ohio.
I love, there's also, Ohio did this thing, if you drive through, there's all these towns, and you kind of, it's like, well, that didn't work out like you hoped, huh?
Oh, Zurich,
yeah.
Ohio.
New Philadelphia. No, didn't.
Is that a real one?
Yeah.
The old Philadelphia is still pretty good.
Huh? Yeah.
Okay.
And it's really close, too.
Yeah, it's pretty close. It's not even that far away. Ransom's parents nicknamed him Ranny. That right. sucks. When Ranny was six, his father, Pliny the Elder, his father Pliny moved the family to Cleveland to take a job as the superintendent of an ironworks. It was in this factory that Ransom was first introduced to mechanical tools and industrial machinery. Just Pliny just letting his little child run around that smelting plant.
Yeah,
yeah.
Play with all the presses. All the
different
big buckets of molten metal.
I had a friend, his dad would sell scrap metal. So he worked, you know, anything they didn't sell, he'd take to this Amish guy in Ohio because he would do all the pressing. And he said, first he would like pull out all the money from a coffee can. But also he said, there's like 8 kids, all under 8, running around. It's just... corrugated aluminum, one of those giant metal presses. They're like in the rafters.
Yep.
Jeez.
That's a lot of fun. After a series of financial ups and downs, the Olds family relocated yet again when Ranny was a teenager, settling in Lansing, Michigan. There, Pliny purchased a plot of land where Ransom's older brother, Wallace, launched a business repairing farm equipment. That business, called P.F. Olds & Son, grew steadily. And by the early 1880s, they were advertising steam engines for sale and offering general machine work. In 1883, with P.F. Olds & Son producing about a dozen steam engines a year, Ransom became the company's first full-time employee. 2 years later, he purchased Wallace's share of the business, making him the new son in the company's name.
I'm the son now.
Couldn't have added an S, Dad.
Do you know how much an S costs?
Thanks in part to a strong national economy, P.F. Olds & Son expanded in 1887.
I'm going to say thanks largely to the economy.
Yes. Constructing a new plant in Lansing with a machine shop, a foundry, a blacksmith shop, and an office space. Over the next 5 years, the company built approximately 2,000 engines. During that time, Ransom Olds began experimenting with self-propelled vehicles. His first known horseless carriage was a three-wheeled steam-powered design constructed sometime around 1886 or 1887. You know, I just remembered when my grandfather was like in his older age, in going into his 90s, he offered me, he had an Oldsmobile sedan as well. It wasn't a big, it was like the midsize sedan. I think it was like in the late
88.
I think it was an 88. Yeah.
Okay. Also under a like you see those, I think they're hard to find because they don't hold. It was that era where they would just fall apart.
I want to say it was like a mid.
Like, but they look good when you see them. You're like, model. Oh, yeah.
It was something like this. Like that. Yeah. That was when I was like about to graduate college and I was like, I think I'll pass.
Was
I
the kinda, Cutlass the small one?
Smaller.
It was a coupe, right?
Yeah.
Maybe. My uncle had
a Cutlass.
A Cutlass.
Well, Cutlass were around for a while.
They were. Yeah.
It was a smaller for an Oldsmobile car.
My mom had I don't know. We're getting ahead of ourselves, but my mom had a late 70s Cutlass that just kind of sat. I was in Hopkinton. It was this small town outside of Boston. Our plumber, because they were doing some work on the house, the plumber was like, "Hey, Mrs. B, what are you doing with that old Cutlass?"
Yeah.
And, you know, sold it to him for a few hundred bucks. Yeah. But then later he came back with like a pink slip. Because he had done an engine swap and was drag racing it.
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty cool.
So back in the late 1880s, in 1892, Ranny built his second vehicle, which featured a flash boiler and was capable of about 4 horsepower and a top speed of 15 miles per hour. This motor carriage was featured in Scientific American and subsequently sold to a buyer in India, making it the first American car ever to be exported.
Wow.
However, the ship carrying the mobile sank en route, which also made it the first American car ever lost at sea.
It's the American car to be exported, but not yet to be imported.
Yeah.
By 1894, Ranny Olds had turned his attention to internal combustion engines. Steam engines remained the bread and butter of the family business, but gasoline engines, including those recently developed in Germany by Gottlieb Daimler and Carl Benz, offered more power in a smaller package. In 1895, Ranny received a patent for what he dubbed a vapor engine. The following summer, he completed his first gas-powered car and demonstrated it for a Lansing newspaper, just 2 months after Henry Ford built his first car in nearby Dearborn. Olds began advertising the gasoline vehicle for sale at $1,000 each, which is about $38,000 today with inflation. He regularly drove it around Lansing, which piqued local business interests. Ransom Olds had built one of the first working gas-powered cars in the country, and unlike many of his contemporaries, he already had a factory prepared to build it.
Imagine that's a good point that like it's a foreign sound at that time, like a engine puttering along. Mm-hmm. But horses, you probably hear horses all the time.
Just clomping around with their big feet. Yeah.
Now if you hear a horse, you're like, where the fuck is that horse?
How much does a horse cost?
Oh, I'm not sure.
I could get you one for $500.
I'm not talking about a race horse.
Just a horse.
The horse.
You're talking about like a teaser pony?
Yeah, it's a very specialized horse.
I have a teaser pony that got kicked pretty hard. I can give you for like $750.
Yeah. Jesus.
In 1897, Olds partnered with several Lansing businessmen to start the Olds Motor Vehicle Company. It was the first business in America founded specifically to produce cars in quantity.
Do you think they have salvage horses?
Salvage.
You can't register.
I mean, you can't register them because they're salvage.
You can't get insurance. You can register them. Yeah.
Yeah.
As part of a new arrangement.
Unfortunately, no, because you shoot them.
Yeah. They turn into glue and dog meat.
Sorry, you shouldn't laugh at that. Dog meat?
I mean, dog
the,
dog
the
food.
Kind that they eat.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah.
There used to be, in France, they'd have chevalerie, which is like a butcher, but only for horses. And you know what it was because it had the horse head on it. Hemingway wrote about it kind of just offhand, but it was cheap meat.
I think I ate horse in Italy, but we couldn't speak Italian, so we didn't really know. But I think it was horse tenderloin, like carpaccio style.
I don't know how I feel about that.
I don't know.
Majestic animals. Go ahead, Noel.
So it was the first business in America founded specifically to produce cars in quantity. Pretty cool. As part of the new arrangement, P.F. Olds & Son, the original family firm, was reorganized and placed back under control of Ransom's brother, Wallace. Randy himself controlled half of the shares. Randy himself controlled half of the shares in the new motor vehicle company, but remained in a management role rather than an executive one. And that was because a local businessman named Edward Sparrow invested $10,000 into the new venture and was named company president.
That's like $385,000
today. Yeah. Sparrow also brought in a partner named Sam Smith, who, unbeknownst to Olds, would gradually wrest control of the company away from him.
And they opened a body shop.
In its first year, the Olds Motor Vehicle Company built just 4 cars. The new board of directors had given Ransom a clear initial directive, quote, build a carriage in as nearly as perfect a manner as possible and complete it at the earliest possible moment. These first 4 nearly perfect vehicles were primarily used as publicity tools at regional fairs to build enthusiasm for newfangled automobiles. In 1899, Olds Motor Vehicle underwent further corporate maneuvering. Orders for cars were coming steadily, but the company's growth was hampered by a limited cash flow. So, Olds Motor Vehicle absorbed the operations of P.F. Olds & Son. As part of the merger, production was relocated to Detroit, or Detroit, where Smith and many other investors lived. The deal also reshaped the company's ownership structure. Ransom Olds became a minority shareholder with 7,500 shares compared to the 20,000 controlled by the Smith family. 5 days after the incorporation of this new company, now called...
Wait, go over the shares again?
Sorry, so Ransom has 7,500 shares.
Okay.
And the Smith family now has 20,000 shares.
Yeah, sorry, somehow in my head I thought 75,000.
No, it's all right.
It's like Succession, hostile takeover.
It is a hostile takeover. 5 days after the incorporation of the new company, now called Olds Motorworks, the firm purchased 5 acres of land in Detroit for a new factory. It was the first manufacturing facility in America built specifically for making cars. But even then, much of the factory was still producing industrial engines because cars weren't yet profitable enough to support the facility.
That's crazy.
Sound familiar? That's how all the new startup cars are. It's like, well, we're not turning a profit yet, but we're making cars.
Yeah.
We're going to be profitable at some point. We just have to.
I think the first slate just rolled off the line.
Oh, did it really?
Yeah.
Too bad about that EV credit going away.
Yeah, now
they
got
to get. So what's going to happen is they're going to get all these purchases before December.
Oh, and it blocks.
So they're going to have, yeah. So it doesn't go into effect. So if you're thinking about it, this is really good. If you if you are a company like Slate, you're going to be able to sell these things ahead of time. With the knowledge that you're
pre-orders. Yeah.
So they might come into a huge.
Wow.
A windfall of cash. Yeah. They also changed the copy on their website to say mid-20s instead of under 20. Mm.
In 1900, the Oldsmobile name finally appeared for the first time. According to former company employees, the name came from an internal contest put on by Olds himself, who wanted something catchy to call his new vehicle.
They gave the name to the name that had the most submissions. Olds himself wrote out 100.
Yeah. The man responsible was a timekeeper named James Brady, who submitted Oldsmobile, securing himself a $5 cash prize and a place in automotive history.
Does that mean that, like, instead of a punch card machine, it's just like a guy, like, all right, you're into work?
Is that the timekeeper? I wonder. Or is he the guy who goes over to the whistle and goes...
Oh, I bet
probably
he does both.
Probably both. Yeah. And Oldsmobile was first advertised in December.
I love the idea. I had never thought about it, but from the intro of to have a mobile.
Yeah.
Like the Batmobile. It's like thinking him driving. Oh, there goes that Oldsmobile.
That's the Oldsmobile.
You know, like it's a personification of the driver.
An Oldsmobile was first advertised in the December 1900 issue of Playboy. No, I'm kidding.
they showed ankle that year.
It was the Automobile Review. The company's official name remained Olds Motor Works, but the new moniker caught on quickly with the public, thanks in part to a hit song called In My Merry Oldsmobile by early recording artist Billy Murray.
Can we hear it?
I want to find it. Yes. Dude.
Billy Murray.
In My Merry Oldsmobile, Billy Murray. Here we go.
Nice.
Young Johnny Steel has an Oldsmobile. He loves a dear little girl. She is the queen of his
dad.
She has his heart in a whirl. Now when they go for a spin, surprise to learn the auto zone.
All right, I think we got it.
Yeah.
Comment on here says, my 12-year-old son is listening to this song all day.
Oh, my God.
What have I done?
12-year-old?
Wow.
That's a little old for In My Merry Oldsmobile.
Wow, it's been 118 years, and it still sounds better than music in this era.
What the hell?
How'd that guy know enough to get on the internet?
That's so funny. Okay.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now back to the show.
During the golden era of the judge court shows.
Yeah.
The guy with the bald head.
He was like, really? Hey, you should. Hey, I'm talking.
Like that judge. I don't know if you know him.
I know.
Anyways, they were, you know, a plaintiff defendant, and one of them made rap music. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, I know. You know, it's like that chupa chup stuff.
Chupa chup.
That's how he described rap music. Like, and I was like, it's just stuck with me.
Chupa chup stuff.
Did you say chupa
chup? So I got asked to be on this other podcast where they watch all of the movies that Siskel and Ebert gave 2 thumbs down to. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember Mafia.
Yes.
With Jay Moore.
And Christine Applegate.
Yeah.
And she comes out and she says, and he's like, this is your son.
Yeah. No,
I'm
daughter.
A mother?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What's your name, little kid? Diane.
That's right.
I named him after his mother.
Yeah. It was so. Yes. It was. It was Jane Austen's Mafia.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like really funny, but they make you watch two. So I watched another spoof movie, Loaded Weapon,
mm-hmm.
one, National Lampoon's Loaded Weapon with Emilio Estevez and Samuel L. Jackson. Yeah. Movies are only like 5 years apart.
Yeah.
But you can see Loaded Weapon is very much a spoof on 80s cop movies.
Yeah.
And like Mafia is like feels modern almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
crazy. I have to rewatch it. They also gave Wet Hot American Summer 2 thumbs down.
And then, what?
Well, and then later they went back. I know Ebert did. I think they both did. But they were like, you know what? We just didn't get it.
It's so funny.
And then they because it was after like they revisit it and they're like, I get what it is now.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought that was
cool. Okay. I didn't think of that as a spoof movie, but it is definitely a spoof.
Yeah.
Sorry, Nolan.
It's okay. But I think they did it because like it was like a spoof. I remember they were complaining like, I don't understand why they have, you know, 20 and 30 year olds playing teen, you know, like,
oh my God.
Like they just didn't get it.
Yeah.
And then when they were like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, we were pretty dumb.
In early 19... 19-
oh, great. Frasier's here.
No, it's Niles.
I know, but that's what...
Nice. Who's the one who didn't get it now?
Thumbs down.
In early 1901, the company started advertising its newest model, the Oldsmobile Curve Dash, a runabout with no windshield and no doors that sold for $600.
And it was a smart-looking car compared to what, you know, it's a pretty-looking car.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Bart, disaster struck. A fire destroyed the Detroit plant, causing the modern-day equivalent of $2 million in damages. Only one car survived, a single curved dash prototype, which two employees managed to push out of the building before it was engulfed in flames. At the time, the company had orders for 334 vehicles, and to meet demand, they set up temporary production in small buildings behind the burned-out factory, but the makeshift facility couldn't keep up. Instead, Olds began outsourcing engines from the Dodge brothers, Horace and John, as well as transmissions from Henry Leyland, who would go on to found Cadillac.
You know, they think it was the cow that started the Chicago fire that also started this Detroit fire.
Well, I was picturing like a Henry Ford covered in soot.
I don't know. Yeah. Too bad about your factory.
This was the first time a car maker regularly outsourced component parts for his vehicles, marking another reason why Ransom Olds is sometimes called the father of the American auto industry.
I think this is the reason that we put this episode on the list, is because we did the Dodge trilogy. And we're like, what?
After the fire, Olds accepted an offer from the city of Lansing for a large plot of land on which to rebuild. So the Oldsmobile factory moved back home. The geographic rivalry between Lansing and Detroit went on to shape Oldsmobile's identity throughout its history. While Detroit became the acknowledged center of the auto industry, Lansing remained Oldsmobile's primary manufacturing base. Lansing offered advantages that Detroit couldn't match. The city provided cheaper land, lower labor costs,
and frozen yogurt,
and a more cooperative municipal government. The relationship benefited both parties. Oldsmobile became Lansing's largest employers and primary economic engine, while the city provided a stable, loyal workforce and strong community support. By the end of 1901, the company had produced 425 curved dash runabouts. That figure jumped dramatically the next year when an estimated 2,500 cars were built, making Oldsmobile the most prolific car maker in the United States. The company's volume was helped by an early form of assembly line production. The curved dash, later renamed the Model R, was the first car to be built on a progressive moving assembly line. Henry Ford, it's woke. Henry Ford is often credited for
it only moves to the left.
Henry Ford is often credited for this innovation. But Ransom Olds did it first with his line, in which the car was pushed manually from station to station as it was built. Ford later mechanized the same process, which greatly sped up production and spawned imitation across the industry, including at Oldsmobile. By 1903, Oldsmobile had become the top-selling car brand in the United States. The company produced nearly 4,000 vehicles that year, which was roughly 37% of the entire U.S. auto market.
Wait, so that means that there was like 15,000 cars in the U.S. at that time?
Even as sales climbed, though, internal tension was growing. Behind the scenes, Ransom Olds had entered into a power struggle with Fred Smith, the son of board member Sam Smith. The Smiths had consolidated control of company shares and wanted more influence over vehicle design and strategy. Despite the success of the curved dash, Fred Smith worried about a possible sales downturn. He ordered Olds to begin work on a new, smaller engine, going so far to say that if Olds wouldn't do it in Lansing, then the Smiths would do it in Detroit. Feeling undermined, Olds abruptly resigned from the board, sold his shares, and announced his retirement, quote-unquote. In a personal letter written shortly afterwards, Ransom Olds made it clear that he had been pushed out. Just 6 days after Ranny's departure, Fred Smith was named the new general manager of Olds Motor Works.
I don't like these Smith guys, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I never like a hostile takeover.
Yeah. Ransom Olds didn't really retire, though, of course. He was only 40 years old and not done building cars just yet. Just months after stepping down from Olds Motor Works, he began setting up a new company across town. He even named it after himself again, this time using his initials REO.
The Speedwagon.
The company would eventually produce a Speedwagon series of light trucks that inspired at least one 70s soft rock band.
That's so funny. That's like us naming our band Pontiac Bonneville or something like that.
Meanwhile, back at Olds, Fred and Sam Smith had solidified control. With Fred now firmly at the helm, the company started expanding its production facilities and developing new vehicles to move beyond the curved dash. They began by introducing the Light Tonneau, Oldsmobile's first 10-horsepower car. The Heavy Touring followed, a faster model powered by a new two-cylinder engine capable of reaching 40 miles per hour. Then came the Model S, Oldsmobile's first four-cylinder vehicle, available in two elegantly named variants, the Gentleman's Roadster and the Palace Touring.
Palace Touring is pretty sick. PT Cruiser.
Under Smith, Oldsmobile produced an impressive 10,000 cars in 1905.
Oh, shit.
But the industry had quickly grown around them, and that figure now represented just 10% of the total U.S. market. Despite its strong name recognition, Oldsmobile was losing ground to competition from Detroit and to Ransom Olds himself, since REO outsold Oldsmobile in both 1905 and 1906.
You know what? Good for that guy.
Yeah.
Good for Ranny.
Nice. Declining sales put financial pressure on the Smiths. They were forced to personally finance the company's losses, spending up to $100,000 a month to keep the factory running. By mid-1908, they were nearly $1 million in debt, and the company was facing collapse. Enter one William Durant. Durant was a carriage maker from Flint who understood something most early automakers missed. The future of the auto industry belonged to whoever could build the biggest company. Before entering the automobile business, Durant had already proven his business acumen by building the Durant Dort Carriage Company into one of the largest vehicle manufacturers in the country.
He built the Durantula, a 100-foot-tall mechanical spider that cruised the Southwest.
Yeah. While his chief competitor at Ford focused on perfecting a single model for mass production, Durant believed in offering multiple brands at different price points. His strategy was acquisition-heavy and cash-intensive. After taking control of Buick in 1904, he used that company's profits to fund an aggressive expansion campaign. The formation of General Motors was Durant's masterstroke. Incorporated on September 16, 1908, GM was designed as a holding company that could absorb existing automakers rather than competing with them directly. Durant's vision was to create an automotive conglomerate that controlled every aspect of car manufacturing, from basic transportation to luxury vehicles. That year, he attempted to buy the Ford Motor Company for $8 million, with Henry Ford...
$8 million, dude.
Back then. With Henry Ford actually agreeing to the deal before Durant's investors backed out. The Oldsmobile purchase, completed just 2 months after GM's incorporation, demonstrated Durant's opportunistic approach. He recognized that the Smiths' financial distress made Oldsmobile available at a fraction of its actual value. Due to Oldsmobile's disastrous financial situation, the merger with GM was essentially a stock exchange. The deal was worth over $3 million on paper, but Durant paid just $12,279 in actual cash.
That's cool.
Less than the cost of four new Oldsmobiles at the time. Fred Smith briefly joined the GM board, but stepped down in 1909.
You know what? I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Dude, this episode, a little twist, man. We went from the story of Oldsmobile to now, like, the real story of GM.
GM, yeah.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
GM's first major move with Oldsmobile came in 1910 with the release of the Limited. The car's name supposedly referred to its limited production run of just 325 units, though another story claims the name was inspired by a publicity stunt in which it beat the 20th century limited locomotive in a race.
This train looks really cool, by the way.
Oh, that is a sick-ass train, dude. That's neat.
Close your eyes, think of train. That's it.
That's it. It's cool.
Choo-choo.
Regardless of the nomenclature, the car was a statement piece. With a starting price well above most competitors, the Limited was available in seven-seating touring.
It looks like the Polar Express train.
Sorry. It does, yeah.
With a starting price well above most competitors, the Limited was available in a seven-seat touring configuration, a two-seat roadster, and a limousine configuration. It featured luxurious options like goat skin upholstery and a built-in clock.
I don't think I've ever touched goat leather.
Me neither.
You think it's soft? Sheep I don't know. Leather is really nice.
Sheepskin.
Yeah, sheepskin.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Now back to the show.
Unfortunately, though, the Limited was not profitable. Fewer than 150 cars were sold in its second year before the model was quietly disappeared. Still, GM's growing infrastructure helped stabilize Oldsmobile's financial position, and the company found firmer footing by focusing on affordability. In 1913, it launched the six-cylinder Model 53, a simpler, more accessible alternative to the Limited. The turnaround was slow, but steady. And by 1915, Oldsmobile grew sales from 1,400 cars to 7,400 cars. Later that year, the company introduced its first V8, the Model 44. When was this? 1914.
That was super early.
That's really early.
What, like the 32 flathead was Ford's first V8, and he was like trying to catch up to Oldsmobile. Yeah. And that was 15, 16 years later. Oh. That's crazy.
This car was priced aggressively, only a small amount more than Oldsmobile's four-cylinder model. The strategy worked like gangbusters. In 1916, Oldsmobile increased production to 10,500 vehicles, with more than 8,000 of them powered by this new V8. Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. Gangbusters.
Gangbusters. Charles Kettering was the engineer behind Oldsmobile and other GM brands at the time. Known as Boss Kett to his colleagues, Kettering founded Dayton Engineering Laboratories Company in 1909, became GM's head of research when the company was acquired in 1916 by GM. Kettering's most transformative invention
That's
was...
That's interesting, too, that he's like, sure, I'm going to buy auto companies. But then he's like, let's buy the other guys making the engineering.
Yeah, it's smart. One roof.
Kettering's most transformative invention was the electric starter, which debuted on the 1912 Cadillac, but quickly spread to Oldsmobile and other GM brands. Oh, yeah. Before electric starters, cars required laborious and sometimes dangerous hand cranking. The electric starter made automobiles more accessible, dramatically expanding the potential market. I think the story goes that, like, one of Kettering's friends was trying to start his car, and with the hand crank, like, whipped smacked up and him. Smacked him in the head and killed him.
Whoa, really? Yeah.
So that's why I invented the electric starter.
Damn.
Yeah.
You need a teaser hand cranker.
Okay. I think there should be, like, foot starters on cars. That'd be sick.
Next, you know, to like the gas pedal?
No, outside of the car.
Oh, you got to be outside.
Yeah, you got to be outside of the car and
kickstart it.
Yeah, kickstart.
You think we have problems with people getting here late now? Oh, yeah, I couldn't kickstart my car.
My Ford Probe wouldn't start.
Kickstarter snapped right off. What would one do?
Hit my dog.
Hit my dong.
My dong.
Hit me in the dong.
Dude, talk about gangbusters.
Kettering's systematic approach to automotive research established the template for modern corporate R&D departments. His innovations enabled many of Oldsmobile's later technical advances, from the hydromatic transmission to the overhead valve engines that defined the brand's performance reputation. Oldsmobile's momentum carried through World War I. In 1917, production doubled to 21,800 units, making Oldsmobile one of America's top automakers again for the first time in a decade. The company entered the 1920s with momentum. Its merger with GM had saved it from disaster, and sales continued to be strong. But that momentum didn't last long. A sharp post-war recession hit the U.S. economy in 1920, and the automaker went with it. After moving more than 40,000 vehicles in 1920, Oldsmobile saw sales cut in half the very next year. Rumors started swirling that GM was thinking about killing the brand. In a bid to project stability, executives at Oldsmobile even hired photographers to stage scenes of bustling factory activity, hoping to make the plant look too busy to shut down.
I love that.
I know.
Well, they're never going to come and look at it.
Yeah.
They saw pictures.
Let's get some people with, like, money in their hands, like, clamoring to buy an Oldsmobile.
Well, this gamble worked, or sort of. Whatever the cause, Olds survived the sales lull and bounced back with the rest of the economy during the roaring 20s. Annual sales now surging past 100,000. The Lansing plant added 12 new buildings, and the company's workforce grew to 7,000 employees.
Damn.
Oldsmobile was once again on solid footing.
It just shows you how fickle the automotive industry has always been. Mm-hmm. You know, the swing between, like failing and winning.
It's also dependent on so many things that are out of the industry's own
economy,
control.
Yeah. Supply chain, war.
As part of the surge of success, General Motors launched a companion makes program, essentially a way to fill the gaps in its brand lineup. This was when Oakland first introduced the lower-cost Pontiac. Similarly, Cadillac spun off the short-lived LaSalle. Oldsmobile released the Viking, a more upscale car with added horsepower and premium features.
The Viking actually looks really sick.
The most notable was its 60-degree V8 engine, which was GM's first monoblock V8, a significant engineering innovation at the time. Unfortunately, the timing couldn't have been any worse. Only about 5,000 Vikings were built before the stock market crash of October 1929. Amid the onset of the Great Depression, Viking was dropped after only two model years and 8,000 cars. By 1932, Oldsmobile sales had dropped to just one-fifth of their 1929 total. By this point, William Durant had left General Motors. Under the direction of new GM president Alfred Sloan, Oldsmobile weathered the Great Depression as part of a larger corporate ecosystem.
Wait, the Piss King? Alfred Sloan? Urinal entrepreneur?
I don't know. I know there's is this Alfred P. Sloan?
I think so.
Know him? That guy's name is on foundations, you know? He's one of those guys.
Yeah, that's right.
Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, not-for-profit grant-making institution that supports high-quality, impartial scientific research.
Okay, that's
according
good.
To them. Alfred P. Sloan's signature idea was the brand ladder, a strategy that gave each GM mark a clear identity based on price and prestige. The brand ladder transformed GM from a collection of competing divisions into a coordinated marketing machine. The concept was elegantly simple. Arrange GM brands in a hierarchy based on price and prestige, then encourage customers to move up the ladder as their incomes and social status improved. Sloan positioned Chevrolet as the entry-level brand, targeting first-time car buyers and budget-conscious consumers. Pontiac occupied the next rung, offering slightly more features and style for young professionals ready to trade up. If you were a yuppie in Silver Lake, Pontiac was the brand for you.
That makes sense in the Camaro episode now. Yeah. So if you were a young kid and you didn't have a lot of money, you got the Chevy Camaro. If you had a little bit more money, you wanted to customize,
trick it out
a little bit, you get the Firebird.
Oldsmobile sat in the middle, marketed to established middle-class buyers who wanted comfort and reliability without luxury pricing. Buick appealed to successful business owners and professionals seeking prestige without the expense of a premium brand. They're like the Volvo, basically.
Yeah, those guys live on Park Avenue.
They live in West Side, Santa Monica. Finally, Cadillac represented the pinnacle of American automotive luxury, the Beverly Hills buyer.
Yeah, so you're saying that Chevy is Silver Lake?
I'm saying Pontiac is Silver Lake.
What's Chevy?
Chevy.
East LA?
Yeah. Downtown. Mid-city.
Mid-city.
Yeah. I lived in mid-city.
Where's Buick then? Is that like Century City?
No, I mean Century City is super expensive.
Buick's probably
Culver City. Each brand offered a clear upgrade path with enough differentiation to justify the price increases. A young person might start with a Chevrolet in their 20s, move to a Pontiac when they get married, upgrade to an Oldsmobile as their career advanced, transition to a Buick as their business prospered, and finally arrive at Cadillac as a symbol of their success. Sloan ensured that each brand maintained distinct identities through careful pricing controls and feature differentiation. Chevrolet focused on value and reliability. Pontiac emphasized performance and youth appeal. Oldsmobile highlighted innovation and middle-class respectability. Buick stressed quality and conservative luxury. Cadillac represented ultimate prestige and cutting-edge technology. This strategy worked brilliantly for decades. GM maintained strict price gaps between brands, typically 25 to 40% increases from one level to the next. The company also staggered feature introductions, ensuring that many innovations appeared first in Cadillac, then filtered down through the hierarchy. Within decades, GM controlled nearly 50% of the U.S. auto market. Damn. Together with Buick and Pontiac, Olds rebounded to form a core mid-market trio that dominated the American auto industry for years to come.
What year is this?
Mid-30s, post-depression.
So mid-30s, they've got 50% of the market, but they're eight companies.
I remember what I was going to say.
How much is Ford and how much, you know.
Yeah.
I don't have any of that data here. Right. I don't know.
Well, I think Ford is about to start chunking into that market share because
the flathead.
The flathead, yeah, that was a huge innovation because they at that time they had the Model A and the Model T, which were ancient by this time. But I remember what I was going to say about Pontiac is it's funny that they were initially the young, sporty brand, but then their clientele had kind of aged out by like the late 50s, which is why they started doing the GTO and got back into the young sector. Because at that time they were looked at as like an old lady company.
Because because people weren't trading up, essentially, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, also just because like a company says it's aiming for this one market doesn't mean that it's actually true, right?
Yeah,
like
we know that Pontiac about Scion.
Scion,
The Pontiac Aztec.
Pontiac Aztec.
I would venture to say Saturn, too, because they started off in the late 80s as like new tech, you know, like plastic panels and a futuristic kind of wedge-shaped design. But I only know old people that drove Saturns, you know, like there was never.
Well, I think it was also there was this thing of like, I'm tired of buying cars. Mm. And so they just got all those old people who were tired of buying cars. And wait, this is a price? All right.
Yeah. I love that it's always like, ah, we made it too easy to get into. Now a bunch of oldies are driving it.
Everything should be lifted or slammed.
Have you seen that video of Johnny Cash getting out of his Ferrari?
No.
Yeah. He's like, he has to like go around his belly.
Yeah.
It's a very
And then
funny.
He like flops onto the street.
As the Depression waned, Olds production bounced back to the tune of 132,000 cars built in 1935, a new company record that included the 1 millionth Oldsmobile ever produced. A new economic boom was dawning, and thanks in part to the Oldsmobile badge, General Motors was set out to become the most unstoppable auto company ever built. Next time on Pass Gas, we'll dive into the slow motion collapse of America's oldest car brand. How did Olds go from pioneering giant to a punchline? What went wrong inside GM? And could the death of Oldsmobile have been avoided? We'll see next time on Pass Gas. That is our show. Thank you so much for listening. That was part one of two parts. Next week will also be Oldsmobile, the conclusion of that story. That was super interesting.
A lot of GM stories are really boring because it is always about the business at the end of the day. Like, there's rare instances in their huge, long history of like rogues kind of doing skunk work stuff and making a cool model, and then that becomes popular.
Your John DeLoreans.
Yeah. You know? But I have more respect for
Duntobs.
Yeah. I have a lot of respect for Oldsmobile, and we don't really talk about them ever on our channel, so it's fun to get into the history of that. Yeah,
certainly.
It's because it was, I think Oldsmobile, in its, we're more aware of its deterioration than its heyday. Its apex, its pinnacle.
And they weren't cut like Pontiac and Saturn or whatever were cut when they were still kind of popular, whereas Oldsmobile like died a couple years before that.
Yeah,
because no one was buying them.
Right. And also Pontiac, they had this push of like, what are we gonna do to save our badge? And they did some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
And Oldsmobile is, I think, to the point of they didn't have as much of an identity as a badge by the time that they were out.
Yeah, it's just
both visually and
it's like a car.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think by the end of their life, Cadillac knew what they were, and even Cadillac was failing in the 90s when Oldsmobile was like going under.
Yeah.
But then there was also Buick, which was also kind of in the luxury old people sector.
Yeah. And I'm sure we'll get to it. Buick tried to reinvent. I think in 96 they did a concept car called, it was the LaCrosse, which never was released, but not as the concept. The concept was like a rear wheel drive V8 with like, I don't remember. It was Gullwing doors.
What?
They were but like they were still trying to figure out what the next step for them was. And I just think Oldsmobile was like, well, we've already done the best things we're gonna do.
Buick is also a really interesting company. Not that we have to get into it right now,
we'll
but like
later, huh?
They've reinvented themselves just recently, and they're like doing great in China. Just kind of a weird, how is Buick still around?
Well, we're going to find out, maybe not with Buick, but with Oldsmobile next week. Follow Bart at Bids Bardo. Follow Joe at Joji Weber. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thanks to our crew, Edgar and Audrey behind the camera there, and our writer this week, Greg Nix. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye. Bye.